John Hurwitz is with us from ESPN. Long time no talk. How you been, John?
Well, not too bad, thanks.
So, do they need to go faster? I mean, you're involved in this sport virtually every waking day that you're out there. I mean, let me ask you the same question I asked Steven at the top. 220, 210, can you tell the difference?
Truthfully, no. I mean, even if you have a trained eye,
yeah,
if you're sitting in the grandstands, I mean, the difference between a 220 lap and a 210 lap in Indianapolis, I'd have to get my time chart out, but it's basically a second or a second and a half. It's probably really not visible to the naked eye.
Right. So what's the point, then, of even exploring the possibility of stretching this envelope?
Well, I think you've got a sport that's kind of been in not necessarily decline for 20 years, because the decline happened 15 years ago, but it's been in kind of limbo for the last 5 or 10 years, where, you know, through a variety of circumstances, the speeds went up for a long time. They hit about the 230 mark, and at some point they decided that pretty much anything beyond that was too fast. At Indianapolis, the number that they reached was about 236 miles an hour. There was some pushback because the CART sanctioned IndyCar series attempted to have a race at Texas Motor Speedway, which is a 1.5-mile track as opposed to a 2.5-mile track.
Right.
And they were lapping Texas at the same speeds that they were lapping Indianapolis at 235, 240 miles an hour. And because the track was shorter without any straights for the body, drivers' bodies to recover, the drivers were running into physical troubles. The body, human body, was actually giving out, and the guys were blacking out. And so there's common sense that at some point there's got to be a number where they really can't go any faster. But in Indianapolis, as you pointed out earlier, speed and new track records were always such a part of the fabric and the history of it, certainly through the first 80 to 90 years of the Indianapolis 500. And they're kind of desperate at this point right now. The interest isn't what it used to be, and there's one train of thought that if you bring back some technology and make the cars a little bit faster and snazzier, that maybe that'll help rejuvenate the interest.
Well, but it also raises the danger level, though, tangibly, doesn't it?
Well, it does. You could argue that since 1996, when the track record was set, that the cars are a lot safer than they used to be in terms of the chassis construction, the materials that they use in the minis days. And then the other big argument that you can make, that it's time to wave the green flag or turn on the green light to go fast again, is that all these oval tracks have what's called the safer barrier now. It's basically a foam wall that protects the concrete. And that safer barrier, which was developed by the Indianapolis Motor Speedway and the University of Nebraska, that's probably been the single biggest safety increase for oval track racing in the last century. Nobody has hit a wall at Indianapolis going 240 miles an hour that has a safer barrier on it, because they've been kind of restricted, if you will, to 215, 220 for the last 10 years.
Now, John, I was in Indy for qualifying last week, and it's the first time I've been down there since before the split, and obviously it's a very, very different, you know, it's still great. Going to the Speedway is fantastic, and a lot of the things about it are, and the history of it is, you know, really compelling, but it's not nearly what it used to be in all ways. Now, if you brought, you know, with the cars they're driving now, you know, can you achieve those kind of speeds? You know, is it possible within, you know, because it is, you know, we are in a different world now in terms of the technology. Can you take the cars they're driving now and push them to that extent, or are we talking about a different, do you have to change the technology radically?
Now, this car is capable of 240 mile an hour laps around there. As always in racing, it really depends on how much money you want to spend. These cars are getting around Indianapolis at 225, 230 miles an hour with 600 horsepower, roughly, maybe a little less.
Yeah, it's about 550, I think, actually, isn't it?
Yeah, a little bit extra for the qualifying. They gave them a little bit extra turbo boost, which gives them probably another 40 horsepower or so. But still, I mean, it's a paltry amount of power compared to when they first flirted with the 200 mile an hour barrier back in 1973. Those cars were, you know, 1,000 horsepower, unlimited turbo boost and everything. And then when you got into the 90s, and they did actually crack the 240-mile-an-hour barrier, the fastest laps that turned of all time, which were out at California Speedway, now known as Auto Club Speedway, Gilles DeFerrin, I mean, he had a rocket ship Honda engine when he ran 241 there, and Mauricio Gugelmann, it was the same deal when he ran 242 in practice. He had an Ilmor Mercedes engine that was just a rocket ship. if you throw enough money at it, you can create enough power. You can, you know, you can make grippier tires. At Indianapolis, there's a solution that really wouldn't even involve the cars. In 1993, they slightly reprofiled the track. They took away what they call the apron, which is kind of an inside line, which isn't banked on the inside of the track. It wasn't actually part of the track, but the drivers often used it to widen the racing line or during passing maneuvers, probably most famously during the duel between Michael Andretti and Rick Mears at the end of the 1991 Indy 500. If they brought back the apron and let the guys run a wider line, it would probably increase the lap speeds by 8 or 10 miles an hour without even, you know, well, cars that you'd have to change some gearing and stuff. But it would be an instant increase in speed just because of the different line they'd be able to take around the course.
Barring that, John, like, again, that's, you know, and it, what can you do other than that to put open wheel, to, well, put it back on the map, really? Because, you know, in Indianapolis is part of that, but there's a whole circuit that goes with it. What else can you do with open wheel racing in North America to at least chip away at that huge lead that NASCAR has now?
Well, that's the $64 million question that nobody seems to have an answer to. You know, the purists all say, you know, bring back 10 different kinds of cars and have competition between engine manufacturers and bring back speeds and all that. And then you've got another group. You've got the marketing group that says, oh, we've got to get the kids interested. And you've got all these different groups that have different ideas about how to do it, but nobody's able to kind of work in agreement. It's a real challenge for them because, as you pointed out, IndyCar racing certainly is not what it used to be. Everybody keeps thinking it's got the potential to bounce back, especially because NASCAR seems to be waning considerably in popularity here in America. It seems like an opportunity for IndyCar racing to bounce back. They've been back together. You know, there's no longer two series. It's been one series now for 5 years. But it's come at a bad time for the economy. There hasn't been really an economic foundation for IndyCar racing to rebound since the split ended. And they just seem to be, you know, stuck in neutral. No matter what they do, they're hurt very badly here in the U.S. by their television package, which has two-thirds of the races on a cable sports network, NBC Sports Network, which is struggling for ratings no matter what sport they're putting on it.
It's got to start at the Speedway, though, doesn't it? Because, you know, that's something that, you know, that obviously they have Daytona in NASCAR, and there are other, you know, the F1 has its great international races, but the history of that place and the track is something that, you know, really that Indy racing has that nobody else has. So it's got to begin with that, doesn't it?
Well, if it starts at the Speedway, then you could argue that the rebound has already started. There was a period 10 years ago when the Indianapolis 500 had arguably become the number three race at the Speedway. The Brickyard 400 NASCAR race came in, and that was a huge success, mm-hmm. an instant sellout. They brought Formula One in there, and they put a lot of money and emphasis on that Formula One race for a few years. But then between the, you know, and it was both kind of tire-related, both NASCAR and Formula One had kind of disastrous events there at Indianapolis because they both had tire problems. What's happened in the last 5 or 6 years since the split has ended is the Indy 500 has reemerged as the undisputed number one race at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. And for us old-timers, that's a great thing. It was pretty discouraging to see NASCAR and Formula One kicking IndyCar Racing's ass and IndyCar Racing's home. The 500 is back, at least on race day. I mean, as you noted, the crowds aren't there on pole day what they used to be.
Sure aren't.
It's a happening event on race day again, and one of the ways that they're talking about capitalizing on that is perhaps running an IndyCar race on the Indianapolis Motor Speedway road course.
Yeah, I heard to close the season. Do you like the idea of a second race there?
Well, I do. I mean, it's the facility. Once you broke that egg of only having one race a year there. In other words, once you brought NASCAR in, once you built a road course and brought in Formula One or motorcycle racing or Grand Am or what have you, if it's no longer just the Indianapolis 500, then you may as well just maximize the use of the facility. My own theory is that they should start the season a lot earlier, in late January if possible. They all talk about how going up against American football is kind of the kiss of death in television ratings. Well, fine, then end your season on Labor Day. My thought would be start your season in late January, early February, before the Daytona 500. You get a jump on the racing fans' interest by being the first out of the box at the start of the year, and then wrap your season up with that race on the IMS road course Labor Day weekend, maybe even Monday, to kind of differentiate it from the rest of the sporting world. And I would, again, if I was the czar, if I was in charge, I'd make some changes to the IMS road course, take away the fiddly little Mickey Mouse bits, and open it up and create a really fast, wide-open road course, sort of like the old Monza before they had chicanes, where you could create a really unique road racing type environment there in the stadium and atmosphere.
So that would be your season climax.
You'd end the season at Indianapolis on the road course.
Is it being discussed?
I think so. I think that the idea of having a road race at the Speedway for IndyCars it's going to happen. There's some talk about whether it should occur in early May to kind of start the month of May, so to speak. One of the advantages to maybe adjusting the traditions of the Indianapolis 500, they often talk, well, we need a shorter month of May at Indianapolis so we can run additional races during May. Well, why not just make one of those races the road course, kick off with a road race and then switch over to oval mode for the rest of the 10 days or whatever.
John, how do you get rid of the perception that drivers are which goes back to, to certainly post-split, where drivers are kind of forever leaving for greener pastures, that you build personalities and build drivers and then they go on and look to go somewhere else? I'm not just talking about Danica Patrick, but you know what I'm talking about, that there's always this other, there's somewhere else where they would rather be at some point.
Well, I think that's really not going to change until you get more quality drivers coming to IndyCar instead of leaving IndyCar. And maybe something like the Kurt Busch test that happened at the Speedway a week or so ago, maybe that's a step in the right direction. I think certainly in terms of perception of the average race fan that only follows NASCAR, having some of these NASCAR stars potentially run at Indianapolis can only be good for the 500. Kurt Busch, I mean, he's not the biggest name out there. He's not Jimmy Johnson or even Kyle Busch or anything like that. But it's been close to 40 years, really, since a full-time NASCAR driver drove in the Indy 500. I mean, I'm not counting John Andretti and Robbie Gordon because they were IndyCar drivers before they were NASCAR drivers. But you go back to the early 70s when Bobby Allison and Cale Yarborough and Leroy Yarborough and those guys ran at Indianapolis every year. That'd be kind of neat to see that again.
NASCAR runs that night still, right? So they run in Charlotte, right? So you still have to do the double for a lot of these guys.
They do, and there'd be some logistical challenges to it, obviously. But, I mean, shoot, if 50 years ago in 1968, if Bobby Unser and Mario Andretti could compete in a race in Italy and a race in Indianapolis on the same weekend, then surely these guys can get back and forth from Indy to Charlotte.